Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
One of my objectives in life is to find out how things really are, the things you don't read in academic treatises. One of them is certainly is advocacy.
Thomas Walde, founder of the Center for Energy, Petroleum, and Mineral Law and Policy at the University of Dundee, Scotland. A leading scholar and practitioner in the fields of international arbitration and the law and policy of energy and natural resources. Thomas notably founded an email listserv called OGEMID, an acronym that stands for Oil, Gas, Energy, Mining, and Investment Disputes. The list connects over 800 arbitrators, lawyers, parties, and scholars around the world by email. OGEMID members contribute daily to vibrant and sometimes controversial debates about the actual practice of international dispute resolution. Often, an OGEMID debate will develop into a subsequent article, frequently appearing on Transnational Dispute Management, or TDM, an online journal that Thomas also founded. In this episode of IDN, Thomas discusses effective arbitration advocacy, giving his advice to counsel on how to persuasively make a case to an international arbitral tribunal.
If I remember correctly, you said you have to have the law and the facts, but if you don't have a story to tell, there's a tendency to lose the tribunal.
Well, I've seen good advocacy, but I also see as arbitrator, as co-counsel, as participant in this game, I see a lot of terrible advocacy. And I've developed here my own theory, which I don't think is that terribly innovative, and I think all famous advocates have always known that. I think in advocacy, you need to appeal what I call the left side and the right side of the brain. The one is an intuitive, emotional one. It is the one, perhaps it's the older part of the brain. I mean, I'm not a specialist on brain science. It is the one where feelings are, where we develop sympathy, where we are impressed by images, stories, and metaphors. And I think there is no successful advocacy where you do not appeal. I think it's the left side. I hope it's the left side, not the right side of the brain. You have to come with a narrative which first is understood. It's not so complicated that arbitrators lose it. Secondly, it must evoke sympathy for your client, for the case of your client, for not just in terms of justice, though that's one aspect, but also the way reasonable people go about doing their businesses properly. Now, I think that's important. And if you're losing the sympathy of the tribunal, I think you have a very hard case, even if it's technically a persuasive one. But on the other hand, there's also the rational part, the right side of the brain, as I call it, not really knowing precisely where these parts are in the brain. And that is our rational way of perceiving things. That is the technical, the professional. That is where you have to discuss in a professionally correct way the jurisdiction ratione personae, temporis and materia. Maybe technical, may not be, maybe for many boring. It doesn't evoke sympathy. It evokes a curiosity in the technical accuracy in the technical games lawyers play. And so I think you need to have a persuasive case on both. If you just have sympathy but can't show that you have a technically correct way for the tribunal to lead it to your client's proposed conclusions, then you may have just pity, but you're going to lose. So it's you have to play on both sides properly.
Well, you know, it's that seems to take an approach to disputes, which is that there's not necessarily any right or any wrong, but there are different avenues to the right answer.
Yes. Well, generally, when cases come to a dispute, they'll have been checked. The easy cases, so to say, have disappeared. And if people go to the expense of making a major arbitral case, I think usually they'll have done an internal check-up. And if it's professionally done, it will show them they may have a chance, but it's not certain. Because at a number of the junctions, the crossing points, there are uncertainties. Uncertainties about the facts, uncertainties about the law. And so advocacy certainly plays a role. And I've seen advocacy, which is so terrible, that someone who had a winning case lost it by not working, understanding the law properly, the treaty in that case, by choosing the wrong experts, by not working with their witnesses, who then came out and kind of caused huge damage to a case. So I actually think advocacy makes a big difference. Now, if it's a losing case, the brilliant advocate can't make it win. But a winning case I have seen being lost or close to being lost by incompetent advocacy. So when they shout, when they insult the other parties, lawyers, parties and witnesses and experts, that's also to my mind a sign they don't have an argument.
So you never want to mention that the text is against you.
Yes.
Well, explain that.
Well, here my essential rule is you should never say the text of the treaty you're applying, the text of the law on which you're relying, the contract which you're interpreting in favor of your client is something which doesn't favor you. I think if you yield the text...
But is that honest?
Well, I think it's really... If I go back, it's kind of German philosophy, hermeneutics. Texts are inherently ambiguous. You never can predict how a particular text will react to the situation 5-10 years later. Texts can be interpreted, and text contracts, for example, they're rarely perfectly drafted. In fact, I would say most of the cases we deal with, I deal with, something went wrong in transaction. They used the model without thinking. They didn't think through the risks and the scenarios. So the text tend to be much more amenable to interpretation. And I would never say members of the tribunal, the other party may have a better argument on the text, but let me argue what the spirit of the contract is. I think if you do this, you have an uphill battle.
You're gone.
You're close. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're close to having gone. And if you really make an attempt at interpretation, you'll often find the text allows you much more leeway. The text, I mean, I've just written here an article on interpretation of investment treaties, and I think the text interpretation, if you do it properly, will give you much more leeway than you think. The other...
But this sounds almost like a literary interpretation,
yep,
of the law. And of, yeah. I mean, when you say text, you're referring to treaty, investment treaties.
A treaty or commercial contracts. Yeah. I believe very much it's more the English approach, not the continental or German approach where you go to common intention, or what was it, who knows what the common intention was, or you go to the spirit and purpose of something, who knows, you can argue. I really believe in very much... ordinary meaning, plain text, but I think the text tends to be much more opaque than you think, and you have to make a strong effort of interpreting the text as it is in favor of a client's case. I mean, the other thing is, which is, so to say, my specialty, is I interpret contract texts in line with commercial contracting practice. I claim that in case of doubt, the parties want to agree in their contract what normal practice is. And if they want to deviate from normal practice, well, they can and they should say so explicitly. This has to do with my background in the oil and gas industry, where there's a lot of standard contracts. So when I have a dispute about joint venture, called joint operating agreement in upstream oil and gas, I certainly will want to find out what is the commercial practice in a particular field. And then I use this as a foil,
right,
as a background, and then I contrast the contract text with it.
Right, but if you put it in those terms, that's not very different from what I think we encounter a lot, at least in my area, which is equipment and services, and that is that the facts are often, we say, much more important than the underlying law. I mean, very rarely do we see that there are actual legal issues or questions of legal interpretation that come up. Much more often, they're the underlying factual issues that are really the key to where the dispute really lies.
No, but I quite agree. I mean, I'm here between the academic and the practice world, and I find in the academic world, they all focus on the law because that's what you read in books and case books and statute books, and you read in your law library, and they don't tend not to understand how important it is, the factual situation, both for the sorry story you need to create, but also for the technically correct way. And finding out the facts in these cases is often extremely complicated. I've been in a case against the Czech Republic as arbitrator, and there were huge amount of complicated commercial transactions. There was fraud and embezzlement. And to understand that sequence of commercial transactions was both very important and very difficult. Looking at facts and finding them out isn't something easy. It's as difficult or more difficult than the law is, because the world of facts is ad infinitum. But how you then select, identify, weigh, and put a story together is essential. Yes. And I'm so impressed, you know, by some of the lawyers I work with, how they then go out, you know, to the place where the facts are, and they dig into files and talk to people, and then they find out things. I've been in so many cases where suddenly a memo done 7 years ago, I've just been in a case where one claim completely collapsed, to my mind, simply because it came out that my client was advised by a big accounting firm that it would go one way, but there was another tax advisory firm who said, be careful. And that be careful memo was dug out 5, 7, 10 years later, and it destroyed the case because you could see they were actually put on notice. They knew there was a problem.
Well, you know, the way that you describe this, this telling the story and building it out of an infinite number of potential facts and working it with the law and the rules reminds me, oddly enough, of what I read about how Miles Davis, you know, the jazz musician, used to work with the musicians in his group. And what he would tell them is, when you improvise, you have to tell a story. You know, if you're not telling a story, then just don't play. You know, that you're better off being silent, but what your goal is to get the narrative out there, get to develop the narrative out of an infinite number of notes that you might be able to play.
I think that's very right. And not only this, I understand little about chess. I mean, my son is playing guitar in chess combos in Vienna, so he knows more. But I understand they improvise a lot with certain given elements. And that is, as an advocate, you need in the hearing. What you do is suddenly something, if your witness suddenly says something or a witness says something you didn't expect, what you do, you need to be then suddenly, you need to change or modify your narrative and fit this in without certainly lying, but so it still appears as a narrative people can follow, understand, and ideally sympathize with.
Sadly, on October 12th, the Ojemid list buzzed with news that Thomas had passed away, having fallen from a ladder at his home in southern France. Many, myself included, expressed deep gratitude towards a man who had gone out of his way to assist us in our careers, connect us with others in the field, and who could always be counted on for his honest, unfiltered feedback, even when dispensing personal advice. While those expressing condolences included many leading figures in international arbitration from Europe and North America, many more had distinctly non-European-sounding names. Often these were former students of Thomas who now hold positions of responsibility in governments and non-governmental institutions around the world, particularly in emerging countries. 10 years ago, one could have said, as some did, that international arbitrations were decided in secret by members of an elite club from the developed world. Thomas's death, and likely one of his legacies, suggests that today international arbitration is more community than club, more global and diverse in its constituencies, and more transparent in how it takes place. One Ojemid member captured it all when he wrote, "Falling down to go up to heaven. Your Thomas." Thomas Waldo was 59 years old.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noire is used with permission.